Accession number 27060, Real One.
This is the first reel of a taped interview with Bill Stacey in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 4th of the 5th, 2004, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Bill, can we begin the interview by you telling us your full name and where and when you were born, please?
My name is William Stephen Thomas Stacey. I was born on the 11th of August 1921 at Lismore in New South Wales. I was immediately fostered by Mr. and Mrs. Stacey and went to Sydney and spent all my young life, my first 8 years, in Balmain in Sydney. And my father died when I was eight, or my stepfather died when I was eight. And my mother, I'll correct that, my mother died when I was eight and my stepfather died 8 days later, through septicemia with a carbuncle on the back of his neck. I was then looked after by my sister, who was 10 years older than me, and eventually went to a children's home at Wentworth Falls in New South Wales. I stayed in Wentworth Falls Children's Home in New South Wales until I was 14 years of age, and done all my schooling at Wentworth Falls Public School and 1 year at Katoomba High School, and then transferred back to Sydney to my sister and her husband, who husband wasn't too keen on having me around the place, so he decided that I'd become a state board, which I did, and then I went to work at McPherson's in Alexandria in Sydney, where I became an apprentice blacksmith, and at the age of, and I joined the Royal Artillery Militia when I underage at 16, went through until I was 18, and then joined the AIF, and we eventually sailed on the 4th of May 1940, and went straight to the UK.
Before we talk about your decision to join the military, let's go back a way and talk about the strongest recollections you have of Australia and England and how they were connected.
Well, my schooling always taught that us to be very proud of our British heritage, and I maintain that right to this time. I think that the British Empire is probably the greatest organisation that the world's ever seen. And I feel very sorry about the people that wish Australia to become a republic, because not so much becoming a republic, but just the fact that we lose our heritage. I mean, other countries die for the people that went before them, but we seem to be giving things away without even a struggle. I can never understand this, and then joining the army at the young age of 16 emphasised this pride of nation and pride of Australia, and as far as I'm concerned, it's all integrated in the one thing. I can never separate the British from the Australians. They're our roots, the things that we believe in, and I'll always be that way.
Had you, as a young bloke, a boy, known much about the First World War at all?
Well, yeah, after I turned about 12 or 14, I started to get into some encyclopedias, which gave pretty good coverage of the World War I and its conditions and how that people fought under and the outcomes, the casualties and the terrible artillery battles, which I think made me keen to join an artillery regiment when I got the opportunity in the militia when I was 16. And I joined the 18th Field Brigade and had three camps. As a matter of fact, I was in camp when war broke out. And, of course, we volunteered, but that our applications had to come individually. They wouldn't take us as a unit for their own their reasons, not ours. And then eventually I was drafted into the 2nd and 3rd Field Regiment.
Why the artillery?
Because of the the technical part of it, and it seemed to me that the gun crews were gun crews, and they had a special bondage between the pit men, you know, because they spent so much time together, and they're all vital to. I know it's the same in the infantry, and I'm not about to denigrate the infantry because they're the greatest, but it always seemed to me that to be on the right of the line, the red and blue, and the royal part of it was. See, in those days, the Royal Artillery was the only thing that carried royal in Australian services, and that was a big thing. We wore red and blue uniforms and leather leggings and jodhpurs and spurs and bandoliers, and it was not only good, but it was glamorous too, you know. An easy way to win a bird, mate.
Well, we'll talk about that a bit later, if you like. Yeah. In relation to the First World War and the Second World War, let's talk about the time in between. What do you recall of the Depression, for instance?
Well, because I was, when I was eight and nine years of age, I can remember the people lining up at the town hall in Balmain with billies to take food home, and if it hadn't have been for the local greengrocers and butchers and those sort of people, the people would have starved to death, because I knew families in the street where I lived that was their whole substance. We were all right in my family because my father worked for the Shell Oil Company and had a job all the way through, but most of the people in the street were destitute, you know. People
talk of things like the Second World War taking people out of that state in some respects later on. Was that something that you experienced?
What was that?
When the Depression finished, the war gave people who'd been through a depression and that sort of thing an opportunity to do something.
Yeah, I think it was the Depression was ending a couple of 3 years before the war broke out, because I know factories start to open in Alexandria and employment became very, very plentiful. And matter of fact, just before the war, it was starting to get hard to get labour. And I know the company that I worked for all my life, they weren't too keen on anybody going to the war either. Earning all the money for the production that they made during the war, but they weren't too keen on their employees going just the same, you know. Although I've got to say this, they paid, not that my wages were very much when I joined the army when I was 18, but they did make up my pay right the way through the war, you know, which was enough to buy a block of land when I come out of the army. You know.
In relation to the Depression, were you interested or did you know of how the Depression had affected other countries apart from Australia?
Oh, yes, I knew that just about 90% of the world was under the same stress, you know. There wasn't... There weren't too many affluent countries, and I could never understand why, but you know, where people could produce as much as they could produce and yet people were starving. I still don't believe, I can't understand that, so, you know, it's always a mystery to me where we've got a country like this that we could supply the food of just about the whole of the world and yet we can't sell our products to the extent we'd like to, only because it's dominated by the big... The only one thing I'd say that I remember about the English tie-up was that the smarties always reckoned that Britain took all our goods and took them over there, remanufactured them and sold them back, you know. Butter was about sevenpence a pound here, and it was threepence a pound, Australian butter was threepence a pound in England. There's one thing that I could never reconcile, that's just business, I suppose.
What of places like Germany? Obviously, they've been hit hard by not only just coming out of the First World War. They've been, as I understand, treated pretty harshly at Versailles Treaty.
Matter of fact, I always felt very sorry for the German people, because they're probably the cleverest and most advanced nation in the world at that time. You know, all their machinery they're outstripping Britain and in their manufacturing, because it became that way. If it's German, it's good, you know. But when they cut their expanding space down, all the other countries stopped them wouldn't buy their goods and everything, and then you only had to get somebody like Hitler to come along, and and the people just rallied him because they thought he could do something for them, you know. But as far as the German people are concerned, I think they're real goers, I really do, you know, in a Teutonic sort of way, but everybody can't be British or Australian, can they?
In relation to the Depression, obviously the Germans had suffered respect. And it made the path for someone like Hitler easier. When was it that you first started to hear about Hitler?
In about 1937. I've read a few articles, and I think it might have been the bulletin paper that I read them in. You know, and it sort of opened my eyes to how extensive this Nazism was becoming, you know.
What sorts of things did they talk about?
Well, they talked about the Jewish problem and the fact that they were setting themselves up as an Aryan race that was superior to everybody else, and I don't think that the average German thought that either, you know. That, and I know that even afterwards, in during my war, talking to German prisoners of war, they were just ordinary people, the same as we were, doing what they were told, the same as what we were doing. You know, the soldier's a soldier. It doesn't matter what he thinks; it's what he's told to do. He does.
What do you recall of things like the marching, the breaking of the Versailles treaties, 36? Walking into the Rhineland. Were you aware of any of that sort of thing?
Yeah, I did. I did. Yeah, and of course, that is, in my opinion, was just because everybody else was unprepared. I mean, Britain wasn't in a position to say, "Hey, you cut that out, or we'll do so and so." So that to cruise along, and I think poor old Chamberlain. Not that I think he was a very strong character, but he had to cruise along. Otherwise, Britain might have gone down herself. You know. And of course, was the Germans were prepared, and nobody else was. That I think that was there.
What then was the feeling in relation to the possibility of war again? When did that start to sort of rear its head?
Well, I think it was people were very, very apprehensive in 1938, early 39. They were apprehensive, but of course, naturally, all the young people, when it actually came about, there was a sort of a sense of elation. Here we go again on an adventure. You know, I think that was just the difference between the... And, of course, people that had experience in the 1418 war weren't too keen on another war, but the people that came after it and that weren't associated with it, well, it was sort of, we're going to war, we're going to clean these Germans up because they're getting the British Empire down, you know. They're against the British Empire, which was the thing in my day, you know. People just loved the mother country. And after all, about 90% of the people that were out here were of English stock, you know, or UK stock anyway.
You mentioned Chamberlain. What do you recall of 1938, when he came back waving his piece of paper?
Yeah, well, in my opinion, it was a culmination of his weakness, actually. He should have done things before he got to that, where he more or less had to concede to Germany all the way along, because there was no preparedness at all. I mean, the Germans could have come straight across the Channel at that stage, you know.
Did people believe at all that it really was going to be peace in our time?
No, I don't think they ever did. I don't think they ever did, because once they let the Germans start to fly gliders and things again, you know, that was just a rerun of the previous, where Germany started to do what they wanted to do. Not Germany, Hitler and his and the Nazi. Because these days you talk to people and you never find anybody that was a Nazi, you know. There wasn't any as far as they're concerned. But,
yeah. What are things like propaganda that you were aware of in relation to the coming of Hitler?
The Germans, in my opinion, invented the word. I never knew anything about propaganda before, but then what a marvellous job they done with it, you know. just through words, they convinced people that they were in the, that they could do things, and they did it. You know, lots of the German victories were done bloodless. Yeah, the early ones are all bloodless. Then the French, you know, well, you've got to expect that from the French, you know. They said, oh, we've had one, they threw the towel in straight away. And the French tanks were better than the German tanks, and they had more of them, and yet they never used them.
Let's talk about that in a little while. Yeah. In relation to the coming of the war, the actual announcement, what do you remember of that?
Well, I think that everybody realised that it was only time, you know, that was before it was on, but I thought that they were stalling and stalling as long as they could so they could organise what meagre resources they had, so they had a little bit to go on, you know. And probably the biggest mistake that Britain made was that they put troops into France when France threw a double take on them, you know, and left them for dead.
Yeah. What was your recollection of the actual announcement by Menzies?
Well,
did you hear that?
Elation, I think, you know. Yeah. It's on, it's been coming, and it's not on, and it is on, and it isn't on, and finally it was on, and we all knew where we were, and we didn't know what was going to happen, but we knew that we were going to war, you know. So we immediately went down and bought a carton of, well, it's a case of grog then, and about five of us sat around and had a few beers.
Well, let's talk about what was involved in actually joining up.
Yeah, well, see, I'd been in, as I said, I'd put my age down. I was 16 actually when I went into the 18th Field Brigade, and we used to go have a camp regularly every year, you know, for 3 years that I was in there, 4 years that I was in there, and it just become a part of your life. Once a week you went to the drill hall, you know, and done gun practice, and then you've gradually sort of formed a circle of friends that lasted all your life. Yeah. And then, of course,
so when you finished drinking, and what was the next thing for you?
Well, I was waiting for the notice to come up, you know, because I'd already, as I said, I was in camp when war broke out, and we'd all put our names down. And the funny thing about that was that the eight of us in the, that put our names down straight away, and we had our first needles while we were in camp, we never got called up. That was early September 1939, and we didn't get called up until March 1940, but then we got called up as a block, and went straight into the unit, went straight on embarkation leave, and sailed on the 4th of the month, you know, so we didn't have a great deal of time to think about anything.
You mentioned that being in uniform was a good bird catcher.
Yeah, that's right.
the feeling of walking down the street in uniform.
Oh, yes. Well, I think it made you feel proud. Well, and I think that's the key word, proud. It made you feel proud. You felt a little bit superior to the ordinary people walking down the street because you had more knowledge than them about the war or army or whatever you like to call
it. How did people look at you?
Well, I think most people appreciated the fact that, you know, although we were young, we were prepared to go into the army and learn a trade sort of thing. Yeah, I got on very well with most people when I was in uniform. I think pride was the main thing, yeah. And the sense that you were doing something, you know. And the biggest thing about it, in my case anyway, is that it kept you off the streets, you know. Otherwise, around where I lived, you would have been in one of the mobs or something like that. And consequently, being in the militia, you had too much to do to worry about those things, you know. And you met a different type of person in that you made friends with, yeah. And if you went out, you went out with them, you know.
What was it like being in camp?
Oh, it was Hard work, yeah. Of course, we only used to get a fortnight to do all we had to do. And just before the war, they picked out 20 of us and from every section and all walks of life, and they put us through a training program on every section of the artillery. That was like artillery board and range finders and gun laying and signals and to get an idea of how long it would take to bring a group of men up to efficiency, you know, which I really enjoyed, because in that camp it was still all horses, you know, and the old six horse teams and single mounts. I had a single mount. I had a rangefinder on. I was 16. I had this Barr and Stroud rangefinder strapped for the back of the saddle, and it was taller than I was.
So what was your, explain your duties in the artillery?
Oh, I was trained as a gunner, and then I finished up in the militia as a rangefinder. And when I went into the...
Explain what that involved, being a rangefinder in there.
Well, there was two men involved in it, and it was quite a big thing. It was 48 inches long, and went onto a tripod, and you had two levers. One stood on either side of the tripod, and you picked up an object, say, 4 or 5 mile away, and you locked onto that, and you brought the two stigmatising bars together so that they pointed on one another, and then the fella on the other side called the range. Well, you'd done that 5 times to get a mean average of the range that you were looking for, you know. Depended on how far it was away. But how accurate that was, I don't really know. And of course, later on they started sound ranging, and until they found out that if you're in hilly country, you could be shooting at your own echoes, you know. Wasn't too much of that done.
In relation to the early part of the war, people say there wasn't that much concern because not a hell of a lot was going on in relation to Australia. Was that something you sensed early on? People talk of the phony war in Europe.
No, I think we might have missed, the average person in Australia, I think, missed the importance of the first lead up to the war itself. But once they become informed, well, then it intensified very quickly, you know. People were, and Australia at that time is a very patriotic place, you know, and notices start to go up, and everybody was for the boys that were going away, and crowds used to line the streets when they were marching down to the boats and that sort of thing. It was exciting times for young fellows, I can tell you. Yeah, so I think that once the people realised that it was for real, that they really, in Australia, they got right behind everybody, you know. Soldiers could do no wrong sort of thing. And it was pretty quick the way they assembled them. And then, you know, in 39 there was nobody other than the fragmentary militia units. And then in 40 they were sending battalions of troops overseas, and they weren't in bad nick either, like for the short period of time that they'd been in training. And of course they weren't all militiamen, some of them were basic people that didn't know anything about the military at all, you know.
In relation to your training, when was it that you began to know that you were about to leave Australia to serve overseas?
Very quickly. Our group of 20 were an exceptional case, because we went in as a block, as reinforcements, because the regiment was ready to leave, and we were trained personnel, so they put us in as a block, you know. And
What were you being told?
Evan?
What were you being told about the situation at that time?
Oh, we're just told to prepare yourself to go overseas. Like, you're ready to go on leave, and you've got embarkation leave, a week's embarkation leave, and then you reported back to the unit, and the next day we were on the trains Well, my group I'm talking about, the regiment had built up, they were, my regiment was half, a third Western Australian, a third New South Welshman, and a third South Australian, and they came together from all over into up to Holsworthy, not Holsworthy, can't think of the name.
That's all right.
Can't think of the name of the... past Liverpool.
We can come back to that if you like. Yeah. In relation to the process of leaving, tell us about that, what that actually involved.
Oh, well,
you've been given leave, presumably you're going back to the camp, and what happened next?
Well, then you packed all your gear up, ready for emigration, sent all your kit bag away on trucks that they were transported separately, and then we had a turnout parade in the very early hours of the morning, about up past 3 or 4 o'clock, and then we marched down to Ingleburn Station, that's the name of the place, Ingleburn Station, and entrained, and went down to Circular Quay on the train, Darling Harbour, I think it was. Anyway, Queen Mary was anchored in the middle of Sydney Harbour, and they took us out on ferries, and we boarded the Queen Mary, and she was still a passenger ship when we got on it. So I was in a cabin with two others, with room service and everything else.
Presumably this is the first time you've been on any kind of ship.
Any ship that size, yeah. And it was absolutely a fabulous ship, you know, and... And we thought we were going to the Middle East, and we headed that way. And it was the biggest convoy that's ever sailed from Australia. You know, there was ships, there's a Queen Mary, the Aquitania, the Mauritania, the Empress of Japan, the Empress of Britain, and the Andes. Tremendous, all really big ships, you know, all sailing along there. Lucky we get to England, that whole convoy, you know, without being knocked off. Yeah, we did spend some time in Cape Town in South Africa.
What do you recall of that?
Well, the thing that got me in Cape Town, the thing that I thought about most, was apartheid. I could never, ever understand how people could be so segregated and separated. I know we had Aboriginals over here, but they were in different context to what they were over there. We had a fella come along, and he was driving a Mercedes, and he picked the four of us up, and he drove us all around Cape Town, and then we decided to go for a beer. So she pulls up outside the hotel and said, coming in, and anyhow, he didn't want to go for a beer. No, he didn't want to do this. And we grabbed hold of him by the back of the neck and got him out and took him in, and there's a big major domo on the front of the door, and he just put his hand on him. He said, you know, you can't come in here. And he was coloured, and, you know, he was as white as me. I couldn't, we put our act on, but it didn't make any difference. He didn't get in. And I just could not understand how that was for them and that was for us, you know. It was people living so close together, and yet they were so far apart. Even the bus stops and all that sort of thing, I thought it was terrible. And so did most of the fellows that were with me too, you know.